A specter is haunting the world.
The specter of communism.
People ask, oh, do you think China is socialist or not? And I'm realizing, in the sense of the working people's movement, socialism exists everywhere all the time. But then in another sense, socialism is like when that movement of working people takes state power and is able to govern society as the working class. Then like the longer term idea is classless, stateless society without any oppression, police or armies or money or exchange value. But obviously we're a long ways away from that.
All right. Hey, everybody. It's Alina and Susie from Cleveland.
And we are the Spectre.
Yeah, we got a name now. Woo, woo, woo. And you just heard our comrade Cameron from New York give us a little taste of what we're going to dive into today. He's going to be joining us during this conversation on China. He also, interestingly, makes the music for our podcast. So welcome, Cameron.
Susie, I know you were like really intrigued by the history of China. So I'd love to hear what you dug up.
Yeah, well, actually what kind of like sparked the interest and the curiosity was you had come back and you made this statement. Apparently it was something that you had heard a lot over there about China's current economic situation, its current economic system. You had mentioned that right now what they're kind of dealing with is socialism with Chinese characteristics. So I was like, what does that really mean? Like, is that socialism? And during my quest for this answer, I delved a little bit into the history of China as well and socialism in China. So I was thinking like it wouldn't be a bad idea to kind of touch on that before we talk about your experience in China and like what you see now with its economy, where it's at, and yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what'd you find out? Because Cameron and I, we were a little late to the China party. We were not able to make it there until 2 days after the program started. So we missed some of the days where they really went over more of the historical context of the party and what led them to their current states. Let's hear it.
Okay, so we should probably start in post-war China. 1950, 1949. Something important to keep in mind is that the Chinese Communist Party was established in 1921. So, you know, a few years before this socialist revolution. In 1949, the People's Republic was founded. And at this time, China embraced that Marxist-Leninist style of socialism, that, you know, Leninist approach to socialism. However, during the early 1950s, there were several different land reforms that were implemented, and this divided the land up in China into like little communes. And I think the most important thing to note here was that the property of rural landlords was confiscated and redistributed. So this kind of redistributed that land to the peasants and other people, and the whole purpose this was supposed to serve was to dismantle classes or like a class structure in the country. Essentially, private property was abolished. I mean, farmers couldn't even sell like the food that they would grow, and I think they were really kind of looking to not fix poverty, but get rid of it.
Yeah, and really develop other ways to, you know, earn income and provide for themselves.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So, you know, after about 8 years of private ownership being in full swing in China, Mao, the chairman of the Communist Party and China's leadership then, had introduced this new economic program called the Great Leap Forward. And it was kind of aimed to rapidly raise industrial and agricultural production. However, this was disastrous. Basically, the normal market crashed because those market mechanisms were completely disrupted. Agricultural production fell behind, and the people of China, the laborers, were exhausted and also not living in good, healthy working conditions. So due to the fact that also the government was essentially providing and distributing the food and resources to the people, because it was really government that was handling that, the people relied on the government for that, this led to starvation because of poor planning on behalf of the government. So you saw starvation even in these like fertile agricultural areas simply because of poor planning. Additionally, many people died in labor camps because they were simply worked and exhausted and they were not living in healthy conditions at all.
I think it's important to keep in mind at this time, there have been some differences of opinion between the Soviet leaders and the Chinese leaders almost from the very beginning of the revolution. Mm-hmm. So up until 1927, while there were all these kind of struggles going on in China against imperialism and Japanese invasions and warlordism and stuff, there was, you know, the KMT, which was the Capitalist Party. It was a bourgeois nationalist party. And the Soviets were like, you guys really need to, like, unite with the KMT. But the KMT was basically more powerful than CPC and ended up smashing them. After, there was, like, a brutal defeat in 1927. And then the CPC started realizing it needs to develop its own sort of approach to struggle. And by the late 50s, when the Great Leap Forward is happening, those had developed into open splits where the Soviet was withdrawing, Soviet Union was withdrawing military support and intellectual support and economic supports and stuff like that. So China was becoming isolated. So I think mm-hmm. it's also good just to keep in mind that, yeah, the problems that are happening in China are also related to its situation in the international environment. So, you know, aggression from imperialism, but also splits with the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And so they were trying to figure out their path forward.
Yeah, and I think, like, it's safe to say that the Great Leap Forward is the period in which China kind of officially broke from that Soviet model. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I almost feel like that was kind of what went wrong with the Great Leap Forward program, was it was this attempt to transition way too fast. So it's like, I think it's like a good thing that they're taking their time and kind of really establishing socialism and taking those baby steps. Mm-hmm. So around 1978, I think this is like after Mao's leadership, there came another period of economic reforms. And this is when the government brought back private ownership. So basically, farmers were now allowed to sell the crops they grew. Entrepreneurs were allowed to start businesses. And because of this, the economy changed drastically. The private sector grew rapidly. This boosted China's economy. And even today, the private sector accounts for, I think, more than 60% of the economy and employs more than 80% of Chinese workers. So right now, it seems like China is at a very interesting stage in its economy because you kind of have this mix of both state and private-run companies. Regardless of the fact that private ownership makes up such a large portion of the economy in China, the state still largely dominates the economy. So it kind of does this in two ways. The first is that there are specific state-owned companies that dominate energy, banks, and infrastructure. The private companies mostly dominate technology, real estate, and machinery. But what makes China, I would say, a socialist country is that the state not only intervenes in the markets regularly, but it also actually owns all land in China, which they can lease to these private companies. So essentially, they kind of own the means of production. So I think that's what makes China a socialist country, but it kind of differs, and I think this is what people mean when they say Chinese characteristics. Mm-hmm. It differs from, like, that typical socialist model, because one thing I've heard is that China kind of, it lacks in the redistribution of wealth and goods to the public. So it's kind of less socialist in that sense compared to, like, welfare states, like the ones in Northern Europe, and it still struggles with that wealth inequality. So for being one of the largest, you know, economies in the world, I would say that there's still that big wealth gap, kind of similar to the U.S. Like, the wealthiest 10% of Chinese families account for 75% of the nation's overall wealth.
Mm. Yeah, that's pretty comparable to here.
I would say so. Yeah. I think it's very similar. And not only that, but also the tax rates for the wealthy in China are much lower than in countries like Norway, Finland, and Sweden. So I think that's almost kind of what's, like, allowing China to grow economically mm-hmm. still. Mm-hmm. And I'm just making an assumption here, and it's like speculation, but I feel like their intention with that was because they kind of still want to be, like, the top dogs.
Yeah. I was actually just reading something, and you could kind of, it was heard in a lot of conversations that we had while we were there, but they were really focused on growing fast, and now and the numbers are there that they've slowed their growth a lot, whether it's intentional or not, but the messaging now is that they're growing with more, with the quality in mind more so than quantity, and, you know, just for the sake of growing. So they're really trying to make sure that their economy is sustainable at this point. Mm-hmm. And we know that that could be kind of problematic if you grow too fast without distributing that wealth properly. And that was actually some, a concern that one of the students had that I ran into after one of the forums. She was concerned that there's still a large wealth gap.
I don't think it's exactly like the U.S. For instance, poverty reduction in China has been much more
aggressive,
significant than anywhere else in the world. Mm-hmm. And, they're on track to eliminate poverty by the end of 2020. In some places like Tibet, they plan to be done with poverty reduction by the end of the year, this year. So there is definitely a big wage gap. At the same time, there is, a big income gap, but that is a definite lifting of the floor. And in terms of wages, there's a International Labor Organization has a report on global wage trends, and it's very clear that real wages in China have been rising much faster than anywhere else in the world. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's so disproportionate and also China's so big, they have to separate global wage trends into two categories, the China and the rest of the world. So it's a complicated picture. The other side of it is that I don't know if I would agree that they're necessarily like trying to be top dog in the sense of like dominating other countries, but they are still like their per capita GDP is still like a fifth of the United States. So it's not as if, it's a big country. So, a bigger economy, it has five times as many people. So, or however many times,
Right.
And I'd say, it's number two for most sources in terms of GDP. So I think that's pretty good. And it's kind of interesting because it's like, you guys mentioned that China has made some really awesome strides towards reducing poverty. Do you have the numbers on like their progress? Because I feel like it was a significant, it was like millions of people that they brought out of poverty.
Well, it's 700 million. I think that's since reform and opening up, but it may be, I was trying to clarify that, whether that was since the beginning of the Chinese Revolution or since 1978, when reform and opening up started. But it's been, over 700 million people lifted out of poverty and, extreme poverty, and the plan is to totally eradicate extreme poverty by the end of 2020.
And I think, like, a lot of economists are kind of, they keep highlighting this point that China's economic growth is slowing in this year, 2019. But I think it's kind of incredible that they've been able to reduce poverty at these numbers, but they're still growing. Mm-hmm. Albeit it's not as much, it's still a stable growth, which is like very impressive. And to kind of go off of what you were saying, Cameron, in terms of the income, it's true, the residents of China, their income has grown steadily, and the income growth of rural residents has outpaced that of urban residents, which is also very interesting. Additionally, the unemployment rate in urban areas dropped slightly, and this is just, we're just talking about the first quarter of 2019, and the number of rural migrant workers continued to increase as well. Do you guys also, like, mention something about what the government is trying to do in terms of, like, urban and rural workers? Like, there's some sort of, like, a program or something?
Well, basically, they're just trying to move people in from the rural areas to the urban areas. And that's how they're kind of trying to improve their quality of life. Because I guess it's just been too hard for them to live in these areas now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like there's some, definitely the geography in some places is pretty extreme, and so it can be hard to build roads and stuff everywhere. So sometimes, one of the strategies for poverty reduction is relocation. If it's just too hard to develop the economy in a specific region, they have built, so much housing and for, really poor, like peasants and stuff. A lot of them are moved into new villages with new houses and infrastructure, but in the urban areas, housing is very expensive.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Well, especially big cities like Beijing.
So let's talk about the trip. So you guys went to China. How long? Why? What did you do?
Yeah, so we were invited out as U.S. delegates with CPUSA by the IDCPC, which is the International Department of the Communist Party of China. So, kind of a mouthful there, but yeah, so they hosted, with like 15 delegates from all over. So there was us, there was three of us from the U.S. There was myself, Cameron, and Rosanna, who's the party vice chair. She lives out in L.A. And then there were three from Denmark, Sweden, Finland, and about six from Britain.
I think there were 22.
Oh, in Canada.
When I counted the thing.
Okay, and then Canada too.
It wasn't all the Scandinavian countries. So it was Norway, Finland, Sweden, and then Canada, U.S., and U.K.
Okay, right. Yeah. So the trip was like from totally, I think it was 10 or 11 days, the end of February. And we started off in the Zhejiang province and then went on to Hangzhou in Beijing. Yeah, so the trip mostly consisted of us visiting schools, meeting with officials, and the first few days they were able to visit a rural town and talk about their grassroots progress and how they've developed those areas. And that was in the Zhejiang province. Like I said, we weren't there for the first couple of days, but Cameron was able to talk to Rosanna, right?
Yeah. So you mentioned, I guess there were two trips in that area, because one was in the village and then they went to see a battery factory. When they were in the village, first they had educated the villagers on Marxism and the resources in the community. And then based on that, the village was able to come up with its own development plan, how it wanted to develop its economy locally. And they also brought urban people and rural people together so they could do mutual sharing of about science and technology, and also agriculture and sustainable development. Since Xi Jinping has become president, the big thing is building an ecological civilization. So, and they have this quote, "The lush mountains and clear waters are as valuable as gold and silver." And so they'll have this quote in all over the place. But then also to promote kind of ecological values, I guess they had brought artists in from universities to paint murals all over the town, on the sides of buildings and on electrical boxes and all over the place. When they were at the battery factory, Rosanna was saying that along with building ecological civilization, obviously green energies is important, but you need battery storage. So they have this battery factory, and also there was kind of a museum, and they had a recycling plant, so you could recycle all different types of batteries. Apparently they haven't figured out how to recycle lithium batteries yet, but they're working on it. And then she also mentioned that the workers are paid a percentage of the profits, but then if their wages from that go below the minimum wage, then the government provides subsidies to make up the rest.
That's cool.
So that, and then she also mentioned that I guess some of the, at least one I guess, of the people on the board of the company or the lead company was a member of the CPC. So that's also partly how the Communist Party of China controls the private sector, is by, they have CP clubs in every in most workplaces, but then also a lot of times they'll allow the company leaders to join the Communist Party so they can kind of educate them and make sure that, kind of keep them in line.
Right.
It kind of seems like, at least in China, the CPC and those the private sector are somewhat working together, if not collaborating. Would you say that's true?
Yeah. This one quote kind of stuck with me. The vice minister of IDCPC, Mr. Guo Yeshao, he shared this analogy with us about a train. He was like, the Chinese people are on a train. Sometimes it goes fast, sometimes it goes slow, but the direction never changes. The direction is always going forward. Whereas American government is like a crab. Sometimes it's going to the left, sometimes it's going to the right. And, it just never knows where it wants to go. And that's really, it kind of puts it in perspective, mm-hmm. We have, although we our two parties are always at odds, and every, 4 or 8 years, or
four years?
Yeah, every 4 years, hopefully this go round, it'll just be the four, things get swapped out for the opposite party,
so it's one or the other.
And there's no clear, we don't have a vision. Mm-hmm. And I think China does have a collective vision.
Okay, but I think it's like, I think China's very interesting though, like in terms of socialism, because I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the way that China's really able to maintain this economic growth is because they kind of transitioned from like a socialist economy to a socialist market economy, meaning that they're really a free market economy at this point, which doesn't really, it's like, so yeah, it's like socialist in some sense, but then it's very like not socialist in another way as well. And I'm wondering if like you feel that the Chinese Communist Party is kind of still straying from that Marxist-Leninist ideology and it's kind of going off and doing its own thing, or if it's kind of making its way back slowly to that Marxist-Leninist ideology of socialism.
Right.
I mean, I don't think it's a free market. I think it's a market that exists within bigger, what they call top level design, but it's like, it's economic planning. Mm-hmm. But then they use the markets to allocate as a tool for allocating resources. So I think that's kind of how they view it. And I think from their perspective, it's like socialism based on the reality that they face. So, and things follow historical trajectory. So it's, in 1978, this was what they needed to do to get capital into the country. And still what they need to do to learn to get like technology development and stuff and learn how to develop their technology. But there's definitely risks associated with it. Like, for instance, definitely if there's capitalists in the party and big private sector, then there's definitely risks associated with that. Recently, I think a big part of that is the fight against corruption. So I think that's partly how they want to make sure that capitalists don't get influence over like political leaders is really strict corruption, anti-corruption measures and institutions.
Interesting. And do you guys feel like the goods and resources have been like equally distributed for the people in China, or maybe like are there like special initiatives to strengthen that in China?
The distribution is not equal. Mm-hmm. But there's definitely, they have social welfare programs. So they have 900 million people are covered by pensions. They do have a life, some type of like a life social security system for, people. They have some housing subsidies. So they do have, different systems for making sure people are able to get their means of subsistence. But I think the main goal is, the number one thing is that they try to make sure people have income through development and employment is the goal. But then obviously, because there is a big free market, there's going to be gaps. So they do have a welfare program to deal with that. But there's still, it's mostly complete. I think 97% of the population is covered by health insurance. 900 million people are covered by pensions, but it's not totally complete yet, the social welfare system. Mm-hmm. Before you were mentioning, how does the Communist Party prevent the economy from becoming dominated by big monopolies? Mm-hmm. And I don't know, but the one thing that I did think was interesting was when we were at visiting a small business, a virtual reality upstart. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that the guy said there was that in China, compared to the U.S., it's really easy to start a business.
The
capital would be available to you, but at the same time, there's much more competition because there's so many people. Mm-hmm. But I feel like it's kind of opposite in the U.S., where it's like it's really hard to start a big business unless you already have a massive amount of capital. Mm-hmm. But there won't be much competition because you can crush people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Basically, with money comes power here.
One thing that stood out to me was the fact that, he made it clear that China made starting a business more accessible. There were less loopholes he had to jump through. They gave him a space for free because, first of all, they value education and innovation. They really want to raise the wellness of all their citizens and make sure that everyone has a better quality of life. And so when someone comes up with a good idea, especially, you know, granted, this business did involve Sony, which is a big name. So it's not like it was some, you know, smaller level.
Yeah.
But either way, they gave this guy some workspace for free. So he wasn't necessarily stressing over the rent for this place that he wanted to start his business. He had that freedom to dream and to work at the same time. And, you know, in America, it's just like, people don't have any disposable energy, you know, or expendable energy.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you know, you go to work and you go home and you're usually tired because you're thinking about how you just worked all day and week, and you probably still don't have too much money left over after you pay all your bills and things like that, you know. So I think even at the base, China values education and innovation. And I think that goes a long way. And, you know, children are probably raised to be more experimental and entrepreneurs and things. And they see it happening more around them. Or, you know, I don't know. This is definitely speculation.
Yeah.
But the opportunity is more accessible there, I would say. Probably for, I mean, obviously, if you're in the city, maybe, you know, not your rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
But city to city. So I know, Cameron, we both really loved Alibaba. That was super cool. Alibaba is basically like our Amazon. It doesn't make as much money. It's not as huge, but it's like China's number one e-commerce company.
Mm-hmm.
So it was started, you know, in the living room of some place in China with just some students and by this guy, Jack Ma.
Can I ask questions?
Yeah.
Okay, like, why, like, I'm curious, like, why it's so cool. Like, what makes it different from a company like Amazon, which is just kind of this, like, gigantic, like, you know, powerful freaking company that doesn't have to deal with tax cuts? Like, why is it so cool for China? Like, what kind of value does it add to China and its economy? Not only its economy, but its people.
That's a good question. Well, I mean, I guess they have services and some reach back programs that really touch the community. Okay, so there's Alipay, which has microloans that range from $1 to $6,000. And I think that's pretty cool because it allows regular people to have access to money to start up those businesses that we were talking about, to kind of find new ways to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to have some amazing credit or credit history.
Mm-hmm. Now, do they charge interest on the loans?
Yeah, the interest is manageable and it's very low,
okay,
like in comparison to here.
Yeah.
Especially for someone with newer credit. Normally, you know, you get that crazy high interest rates.
Yeah, well, especially because I know, like, in America specifically, it's almost like the placement of those, like, really quick cash credit. They're placed in, like, low-income communities. The fact that the interest is so much lower is really awesome, just because, like, you know, gives working people a shot at, like, pursuing some sort of, maybe, like, a starting a business or something with a small loan, and it gives them kind of that opportunity without actually in the end, like, in the long run, kind of screwing them over.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the thing that stood out to me at Alibaba was when we first got there, and I guess one of the senior executives was the guy giving the tour, but he said, like, his opening thing was, he's like, oh, some people say that Marxism is no longer relevant, you know, with technology, because there is no working class or something when jobs get automated. And he said, but actually, I think Marxism is more relevant than ever, because when robots take over the jobs, what will we do? He said, well, maybe we'll just relax. So I think that's it. That says a lot about how, what is the role of technology in China? It's to make a better life rather than just to, you know, increase labor productivity and throw everybody out in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
and then I guess so I guess when you see all this new technology and stuff like that, and then, you know, automating the warehouses and stuff like that, I could definitely relate to that because I worked for a little bit at UPS in the warehouses, and they would have equipment in there from the 70s, and you're like leaning over on these rollers that are broken, and they do not care if you're working on an old roller or a new roller. You have to work, you know, just as fast no matter what, and it's backbreaking work. Mm-hmm. I would definitely rather work in a warehouse where most of it was being lifted by machines, or, you know, where you're just maybe watching robots move packages. That definitely sounds nicer.
And I think, and hopefully, I think, you know, they'll continue with their social welfare program so they can support the people that wouldn't be out of a job because of that. Mm-hmm. So here, we don't really have that luxury of having robots take our job.
I also think it's like why planning is so important, because every single time the economy is upgraded, it means you need a whole new plan for the economy. What are the new jobs going to be? Like, every single time they're upgrading the technology, they have to upgrade the whole structure of the economy so that, you know, there's a plan for where is the new labor going to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, like, China is in a really good position because of their planning, specifically their education. Like, the fact that they're investing so heavily in their education, I think, allows for people of all income types to pursue jobs in the technology field. Whereas I feel like with, you know, in America, there are certain initiatives and programs that encourage, like, young girls, you know, brown and black kids from low-income communities to pursue technology, but there's still a huge gap in the demographic of individuals who actually do pursue computer science in America. And that's, like, my one concern with this age of automation in America, is that we would be actually, you know, taking jobs from people who don't have the skills or the education to maintain the machines, basically. Because I think, like, it's going to create this upsurge in jobs for people who have the technical skills to not only, like, program and create these machines, but also maintain these machines. So I think, like, China's in that perfect position where automation can really help them and kind of take the load off of people in terms of, like, tedious work.
Oh, and also we learned that every single student in university has to learn Marxism. Has to take a, like, Marxism is a mandatory course in college.
Interesting. And so is there any sort of, like, requirement? Like, does everybody in China have to be a member of the Communist Party?
No,
but the application process is really strenuous and could take years.
Really?
Yeah. And a lot of people don't join until they go to college. And a lot of them go away to college in the States and then come back. Or no, they go away thinking, like, yeah, I can't wait to get a taste of this Western culture. And, you know, I'm so excited. And, you know, they're so into it. And then they come back really appreciative of home and of the Communist Party. And then that's when they join.
Wow.
Yeah. So we heard a lot of stories like that from all of our hosts who, you know, that you think you're getting something new and different and more freedom, but you see how people are living and you appreciate where you come from.
Wow.
And also, even with that strenuous application process and all the rights and responsibilities associated with being a Communist Party member, they have, it's still the largest party in the world. There's 89 million CPC members in China, and that's, I think that's about like one in every 6 or 7 people or something like that.
Wow. Mm.
I think they got the capitalist on under wraps.
Yeah, there's not enough of a labor force there to handle those capitalists.
Right.
All right. Maybe just one thing on that, that it seemed, the impression I had was that the CPC is very open to criticism and like acknowledges its mistakes and tries to correct them.
Yeah, and to kind of add on that really quick, I really appreciate it. When we were asking some questions in different settings, they were not scared to say, we don't know, but we're working really hard, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that is respectable.
Yeah, that is really respectable.
Mm-hmm.
There's some authenticity there.
Absolutely.
That's awesome.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thanks, Cameron.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. So we'll keep you posted and talk to you soon.
All right. Cool.
All right. Bye.
Bye. For anybody who's listening and maybe you guys have some questions, maybe, you know, you want us to clear something up, maybe you have something to just contribute, feel free to email us. Our email is youngcommunists@cpusa.org, and we'll try to answer your questions best we can. What we have next up is one of our other comrades, Michael. He had the privilege of visiting Venezuela,
so he will be talking to us about that, and we're looking forward to it. Okay, everybody. Thank you for joining us on today's episode of The Spectre. We'll catch you next time.